take a $30 in my pocket. What you doing? I holler, come on, Cecil, take a dollar. Machine, and he said, come on, please give me a dollar.
Hello, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Judy Joy Jones Show. I want to tell everyone that the song you heard was Ricky Lee Jones, two-time Grammy winner, Danny's All-Star Joint. Ricky Lee was our guest a few weeks ago. She has just started on a USA tour, and you can find out how to buy tickets wherever you are by going to rickyleejones.com. This lady is one of those unique geniuses, one of a kind, and I just can't say enough for her. If you get a chance, run. Just run to go hear this woman sing. Also, Ricky Lee is actually wanting to give away some of her horses. So if anybody is interested, you can contact me at joy@creationisbliss.com. Creationisbliss.com. And tonight we have a very special guest who is actually coming back for the second time. His name is David Parnell. David Face the Dragon, that's actually what his website is called. He was very, very addicted and to crank. And because of this 23-year addiction, it almost took his life. But thankfully for us and for all the children's lives that David is now touching, it didn't. And he is going to tell his story, and I want to ask anyone out there that feels this might be an important show for someone else to get them and let them hear this. If they're not able, they can download the archives through the Judy Joy Jones Show Blog Talk Radio. Our call-in number is 347-326-9915, 347-326-9915. And if you want to chat, go right ahead. The chat room is open. And also, I'm going to very briefly just give a couple of plugs for some upcoming shows. On Saturday night, we have Gloria Minrock. She is a publisher and an author, and Gloria does more for poets and authors around the world than anybody I've ever known. This woman just works 24/7, not only publishing her own books, but those of many, many other people. And she also broadcasts the events. Gloria is just a really, really nice person, and I hope you can tune in on Saturday night. And then next week, we're going to have the inventor of the telephone to the dead. That's right, folks. You heard me right. The telephone to the dead. Before Thomas Edison died, the inventor of the light bulb, Thomas Edison, he was working on a telephone that he might be able to call people that have crossed over. I think what we do is we get psychics. We pay psychics to contact people that crossed over. But Thomas Edison believed that we ourselves are able to do that directly. And he felt there was a telephone, just like I'm talking to you now through a telephone, that would enable us to do that. But, as fate has it, he crossed on over. Well, Christopher Moon, who is going to be our guest, will explain how he talks to Thomas Edison through this telephone that he invented. And I hope that you will definitely come and listen to that show, because Christopher, he's ahead of his time, and we will all have a telephone someday where we'll finish whatever it was that we didn't get finished with the relatives that crossed over. So nothing is ever finished. Let me go ahead and bring our guest up. Again, the number for tonight is 347-326-9915. Hello?
Hello?
David?
Yes.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Oh, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for coming back. As fate would have it, the show we did do had to be axed because of technical difficulties, so maybe a premonition, something got us to go ahead and set this one up, and I'm ever so glad.
Yeah, I believe so, too.
And where have you been? I understand you've been out talking to schools, or?
No. When did you do the show last? It was a couple weeks, right?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, I just got back from Nashville this morning, but I actually was down there visiting my uncle in the hospital who was in a coma.
I'm sorry.
From diabetes, and he's come out of that. But I don't think that I have been anywhere since the last time that I talked to you. We start the schools back in August and September. This summer, we don't have any schools.
I see. So you're kind of on a vacation yourself. Well, I know that you went through everything when we talked the first time, David, but as I said, that show is no longer available for anyone. I hope that you're able to understand that and be able to go through a little bit of, briefly, of what led up to what you're doing today, as you did when we first spoke. I know that you had mentioned that your father actually was the one that introduced you to drugs. Nothing vindictive about it, but that's just what he was doing, so he wanted to share it with you. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, you're right.
And so once he did, you kind of just got really, really addicted really quick, because you were like really, you know, you were a young child. And it just led to more things.
Yes, I was 13 years old when I first started smoking marijuana with my dad. And of course, I was running around with the older kids at school, and as their addictions progress and they move on to harder things, I moved on to harder things right along with them. I only seen my dad in the summers, so I wasn't around him all the time, but once I started getting high with him, of course, I searched out for the other kids around me that was doing the same thing, and went from marijuana to alcohol and pills, and eventually at 18 years old to cocaine.
Wow. So it was just a matter of time before you got into the real hard stuff. Now, when you were on cocaine, evidently from what I've read and what I remember you talking about, it wasn't really as bad for you as, is it crack? I'm sorry, crack or crank?
is crank. Crank is meth, and crack is cocaine.
I see. Okay, so the crank is what really just blew your life apart, right?
Yeah, it really did. At 21 years old, my first marriage failed, and I moved to Dallas, Texas. And I really thought at that point that my life couldn't get any worse and how wrong I was, because I moved to Dallas and got turned on to methamphetamine, which we call, a lot of us call crank, and it was just really downhill from that point on. And it was so much more potent than cocaine. The high lasted so much longer that I was able to abuse it much harder than I was the cocaine, because I couldn't afford really to abuse the cocaine like I probably wanted to at the time, because the high didn't last very long, and it cost quite a bit of money to really stay going for days at a time on that drug. But it didn't with meth. I could spend a little bit of money and stay up for a couple of days at a time. So it was a drug that I eventually abused severely, and of course it broke me down mentally and physically both.
Yeah, it just brought your life. I understand now. I didn't quite get it before, but because the cost is so much less than cocaine, therefore you can keep the high going longer and longer. Okay, because I never quite understood. Well,
No, that's not. It's not actually the cost. Back years ago, whenever I got turned on to crank, they both cost the same amount of money for the same baggie weight.
Oh, okay.
But the high with the meth lasts so much longer than the high with the cocaine. It actually made it cheaper, because with cocaine I would spend $25 and I could go through that $25 worth in 2 or 3 hours, where with meth, with crank, I could spend $25, get the same amount, but I would be awake for 2 days. The high would last just so much longer.
I see. Well, when did you realize that you were actually an addict to this particular drug, David? What was it that you one day just knew, I'm an addict?
Yeah, well, it wasn't the first year. When I was 21 years old, I stayed in Texas for about a year and a half, and when I left Texas and come back to Tennessee, if you had told me that I was a meth addict, I would have told you was crazy. I'd have said, I can quit anytime I want. I just choose not to. It was years later, I went for a few years before meth actually made it to Tennessee, and once it hit Tennessee, I got back to using, and I started staying up 4 or 5 days, and I wasn't taking care of the kids, and I couldn't go to work. I'd become physically sick, but I still would spend every penny that I could scrape up on the drug, and I believe it was when I turned around and my electricity was off, my kids didn't have any milk, and I knew that I had a serious problem.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, whenever you did realize you had a serious problem, what did you reach out to or for or in as a solution? I mean, here you were, and you had the family, you needed to get them food, you needed to pay your rent or whatever. Well, so who did you turn to?
Well, I didn't really know what to do. I didn't know anybody to turn to, and at that point, the paranoia from the drug had set in on me, and it was very severe.
Oh.
And I really didn't know where to turn. I would try to self-medicate myself or substitute one drug for another. There would be times that I would say, I'm not going to do any more meth. I'm just going to stick with marijuana. And I would try to kind of use the marijuana to come down off of the meth.
Okay.
And that would work for a few months, but eventually I would be back on the meth.
I see. So it was all these mind games, but more or less, well, whenever the meth dealers, now, are most of them themselves addicts, David? Is that why they're able to go up to very young children, because they absolutely need the drug themselves?
Yeah, most of them that I've been around, now I'm sure that there's some somewhere that's not, but most of them where I live are using themselves and are also addicts. And you know, and and are either cooking the drug or cooking it and selling it both.
Okay. So they have, they don't have really like any moral thing going there or ethics, because they themselves need the drug in some form for their livelihood. Am I correct? Besides if they're an addict themselves, but because I'm trying to find out what it would be, you know, what type of person would actually go up to a child, an elementary child, you know, a real young child, an elementary school child, and offer them a drug. It's incomprehensible to me, but I guess if there's that huge need, if it's financial or physical, then that would be the reason.
Yeah, I think that you're right there, what you just said. And a lot of times they'll use young family members that's in their family to entice, kind of use them to entice other young kids, and they'll get some of their family members to try to push it on the kids at school, that's in the school. I just read a story just a couple of days ago where there was a man who started giving a girl meth at 8 years old, and in the course sexually abusing her, and he eventually raped her, and this went on for many years, but she was 8 years old.
So she really had just been absolutely abused to the point, and I don't know, you know, what would have happened to her, because when you're that young and that impressionable, I know the first show you mentioned there was a, I think you said a mother that actually prostituted her 1 year old child for meth, and yes. I was just, you know, most people can't understand that need, but I suppose meth makes the need to where somebody would do that sort of thing.
Yeah, it does and of course every meth user isn't going to do something like that, but you never know who it's going to affect like that. And you will see some of the most bizarre things with meth users that most people really can't imagine. You know, I've seen them get paranoid and pull their own teeth out because they think that somehow the police have put some kind of chips in their teeth hear what they're saying. And the mother prostituting her one-year-old daughter, what was really shocking to me, that was shocking, but what really shocked me is when I asked the police that told me about it, I said, did she have any customers? They said, at least three that we knew of, you know. And I have seen things over the last few years that I actually never seen when I was using the drug, and some things that have really really been shocking.
Well, it absolutely takes over your whole life, evidently. And the younger you, I guess, are exposed to it, your brain is not completely formed, so that part of you that has discrimination just wouldn't be there. I mean, it wouldn't have ever developed. Or, you know, I say take responsibility for your own life, but if you touch somebody's brain when they're young enough, when it hasn't completely developed, to me that's a whole different ballpark. And it would be like the young child, 1 year old, you know, who knows what she would be like. You know, I have a question that's coming up in my mind. If there were, let's say, just to make things like up and up, where people didn't have to do anything like sell their own children, what if there were places people could go, David, and get what they need? How do you feel about that? You need a meth fix, go down the street. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't like that idea because I love people, and I know that they're going to die on this drug unless they stop using it. My dad, he just died May the 30th in Oklahoma, and I know that my dad would still be alive if he hadn't have been using meth. And so it might help in some of the areas.
Right.
But far as that individual, it's not going to help that individual any at all. It's only going to make it, I believe it will only kill them faster, because if they have that easy of access, they're probably not going to want to ever come down. And
I see. So they'll just take it and take it. Well, was your father an addict even to the end of his life?
Well, my grandmother said that he had made peace with God, but some of the other people, when I went to the funeral, said that some of the family members said he was using a few months ago. So I don't know if he had quit at the end, I do know that he had cirrhosis of the liver and hepatitis C and pneumonia set in. And I just know that he would still be alive if he had stopped. So I know he had used in the last 6 months. I don't know about that week or the day before or anything like that.
But the last 6 months. And how old was he when he passed on, David?
He was 64.
64. I always think of an addict as being rather young, you know, under 40. But you're telling me, no, your father never could shake it. So this is not, meth is not something that you just try. I mean, who knows what makes an addict and who doesn't, you know, in the brain. But if you are prone to that DNA or whatever, it doesn't let you go, huh, David?
No, most don't. I thank God every day that I got away from it, because there's a lot that don't. And I have seen them in the meth houses here in Tennessee where I live. I've seen the age go from 13 years old to 65 years old in the house using the drug with, say, 20 people, and that's how the ages would range from 13 plumb up to a senior citizen that was in the house using. So it's not just a young person drug. I was in Mississippi last year, and they had arrested a district judge who was buying chemicals to make meth from Alabama, who had crossed over into Mississippi. This drug has crossed every boundary there is. I've known school teachers, bus drivers, registered nurse, a deputy sheriff who the sheriff's department had to arrest one of their own men. So it's not just the drug that affects like the poor people in the trailer park neighborhoods. Just
across
every boundary. Nobody
is immune to it.
That's right. Nobody is immune to it.
So it gives you some kind of exhilaration that makes you feel blissful or peaceful, and you just want more and more and more and more. But it's not you can't go buy it in a store, so you've got to deal with the street thing, and that to me is where it all just kind of turns really horrible, because you're exposed to hepatitis and everything else. It's not like you just go into a liquor store and buy liquor, or you just go into they even have methadone clinics now, but I think meth. Now, that is not related to methadone, right, David?
Right. It's not related at all.
Okay.
Methadone is really just a speed. That's what meth is. It's a speed. And it speeds people up. It gives them a whole lot of energy. They stay awake for days at a time. Most of them don't eat. Whenever they are up, and they eventually become very paranoid, their pupils become very large. Most of them become very irritated, and they lose extremely large amounts of weight. And a lot of times they'll age. Looks like they've aged 20 years in 4 or 5 years with this drug.
Yeah, you know, I have seen people that have been on it and said, you know, that they were, well, actually, mostly, I guess I didn't know it was methamphetamine. It would be like maybe truck drivers that looked really older. And I think they said they took some kind of speed, but I don't know for sure, you know. But it does seem to age you. And that's just one of the drawbacks. Well, whenever you were finally trying to get off it, what happened, David, that you would have gone to such an extreme to try to end your life instead of, let's say, going to a psychiatrist or a counselor or a church or whatever?
Yeah. Well, I was going to see a psychiatrist.
Oh, you were? Okay.
Yes. After the first suicide attempt, I started seeing a doctor, and that's how I kept my job. I was an addict that I kept my job from down till I shot myself, but I first tried to hang myself 3 years earlier from the depression and anxiety from the drug, and I thought my wife and kids would be better off with me dead, and they sent me to a doctor. He put me on medication, but the problem was I wouldn't take the medication like I was supposed to. I would take it as long as I wasn't using, But every time that I fell off the wagon and started back to using meth, I would quit taking the medicine that the doctor was giving me, and now I'm back on the meth. And so it was just a roller coaster ride with the depression and the anxiety for me, just up and down. I could get off of meth for 4 or 5 months. I would start leveling out, feeling good, and then all of a sudden I would go back to using the drug. And each time seemed like it was worse than before. I would stay up longer each time. I eventually started staying up 8, 9, 10 days, and I thought the only way out for me was death. And I thought, was convinced that my wife and kids would be better off, because I didn't think I could quit. And I tell young people, that was the worst mistake I ever made in my life, thinking killing myself was going to make anything better. I really believe it doesn't matter if a person tries to quit alcohol or drugs 1,000 times and they fail.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe, as long as they keep fighting and they keep trying, and if they really want to be sober, I know one day they will be able to kick it. So for your audience, if somebody is using, please, whatever you do, don't stop trying to quit if you really want to quit. Don't beat yourself up too bad whenever you fail. And I know how us addicts think. We think, I knew I couldn't do it. Nobody believes in me. Because I want to tell you, there's thousands of us that do believe in you. We know in our hearts that you can quit, and you really can. Just keep fighting.
Just keep fighting. And whenever you tried to hang yourself, what was it that brought that on? Was it just like you're saying, desperation, that this is never going to end? I'm just not going to have any peace.
Well, at that point, I had been hallucinating. Most meth addicts, the real heavy ones, most of us start seeing things. And we usually start out seeing what we call shadow peoples. That seems to be the most common thing. From what I've talked to people all over the country, that seems to be the most common thing. I was seeing shadows. It looked like a person, but it was a shadow walking around. And I've seen all kinds of other weird stuff. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the hallucinations that got me, because I eventually got used to it. Most of the time when I would see something that was really far out there, I knew in my own mind, I thought, well, I'm hallucinating today. But
okay.
One thing I never got used to was the noises and the voices that come along with meth. For a lot of the users, my wife and kids had left me. I had just gotten out of jail from pointing a gun at my wife, threatening to kill her. I was very abusive towards my wife when I was on this drug, and Amy had me arrested, and I had gotten out of jail, and her and the kids were staying with their grandparents, and I was sitting on my porch, and I actually was coming down off the drug, been up for 4 or 5 days, and I heard, mm-hmm. At this point, I had been hearing noises in my house, like people walking around, sound like footsteps, sound like people whispering, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. That was actually the first day I ever remember hearing the voice clearly. And it sounded like a man's voice, and it sounded like an audible voice. He said, you know, your wife and kids would be better off if you was dead. He said, the world would be a better place without a guy like you. And what that voice said to me next wouldn't have meant a thing in the world to me if I had been told about Jesus through my grandfather, who was a preacher, and my mother my entire life. But that old dragon always knows our breaking point. Everybody has different ones, but this was my breaking point. He said, you really think Jesus is going to forgive you for the things you've done, the people that you've hurt? And I remember like it was yesterday saying out loud, I said, no, I don't think he will, because I knew in my own mind that I had done some terrible things in my life I shouldn't have done. I've hurt a lot of people physically and emotionally, not only in my own family, but across this country dealing drugs. And I got up off of my chair, went to my barn and tied a rope up in my barn, going to hang myself. And about that time, the Lord sent my sister over to check on me. I know God sent her over there now. But when she pulled up, I thought, if I'm going to do this, I've got to get her out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her I needed some stuff from a store, asked her to go to town for me. She agreed to, and as soon as she pulled out my drive, before her car even got going down the road good, I had the rope around my neck and was stepping off my old riding lawnmower, and just started choking me and hurting. It brought me back to my senses, and I thought, what are you doing? And I reached and tried to grab the rafters, but I couldn't reach them, and I tried to get my foot back up on the mower, and that was the last thing I remembered, because it was too late to change my mind. In a matter of seconds, I was unconscious, and when I woke up, my sister had found me. The rope had burnt and cut me from ear to ear, and it took me about a week to get to where I could swallow good again. But I was still alive. The rope was broken, too. And I tell young people, I guess when my body went to a convulsion and started jerking it, my body weight snapped that old rope. that I had used. But I know the Lord saved my life that day. But I didn't take advantage of that situation like I should have. They sent me to a preacher instead of a rehab center. The preacher helped me a bunch. I got off a dope for about 5 months, and I started seeing the psychiatrist.
Sure.
And but when I went back to work, I started hanging around the same old buddies I had been hanging around before.
Yeah.
And I think just a few weeks, I was back to using with them. And I tell young people, and I tell all people when I do rehab centers and stuff, I tell them, look, if you really want to kick a drug or alcohol habit, one of the very first things that you have got to do is get away from the people you're running around with. There is no way an addict, just like an alcoholic, can't go hang out in a bar. No way an addict can hang around other drug users and say, hey, I'm going to quit using. You just can't do that. You've got to get away from the people you're using with. Now, I'm not saying you quit loving them. Start praying
right.
for them, but stay away from them. When I got back on the drug with the guys at work, that's when I just give up. I thought, what's the use of trying to quit? I'll never get away from this drug. I started staying up 8, 9, 10 days at a time, and my routine was to eat a couple of sandwiches in like a 7-day period when I was using. That's about all I would eat, and I went from 200-plus pounds to 150 or 60 pounds. I no longer felt strong. In the beginning, the meth made me feel strong and full of energy when I was 21. I thought I was thinking clearer than I'd ever thought before, but at this point, I couldn't think clear, and I didn't feel strong anymore. And that's when the paranoia got severely bad. I was paranoid of my wife, my own mother, and the abuse towards my wife got worse. I neglected my children. I remember thinking in my own mind that I was a pretty good dad because I thought, well, at least I don't use the drugs in front of my kids. That's how I thought I was protecting them.
Oh, okay.
Back then, I would have told you I got a drug room in the back of my home where I use my drugs. If my kids need me, all they got to do is come back here and knock on that door, and I'm there for them. But the truth is, I never was there for them. But I know a lot of parents do that, and that's how they justify it in their mind. They think, well, I'm not doing so bad because I keep it hid from the drugs. But we are still doing bad, and my kids, like I said, were severely neglected and abused. And eventually the suicide thoughts got to where it was almost on a daily basis when I was using, and I come home one morning on February the 21st, 2003, at about 9 o'clock in the morning. I had been up for about 4 or 5 days again, about a week, and I come home, and I was physically sick. I could hardly stand up, and I had a form of Parkinson's disease that set in on me where my arm shook all the time, and I asked my wife to lay down and talk about it because her and the kids was leaving when I come in that morning. They said they was moving to their grandparents. And I asked Amy to lay down and talk about it, and she agreed to. But as soon as she laid down next to me, she said, I'm going to lay here and talk to you for a minute, but me and the kids are still going to leave. And when she said that, something in me snapped. I reached over her and grabbed my SKS rifle and laid it on my stomach, and I thought, man, that's it. I'm going to blow my head off. This dope has robbed me of everything. And she screamed and reached over to grab the barrel out from under my chin. But before she could grab it, I pulled the trigger, and the bullet went in me under my chin and come out between my eyes, breaking every bone in my face except my left eye socket, blowing my nose off, all my front teeth out. And but I was still awake. That was an amazing thing to me. It did knock me unconscious. Meth is such a strong stimulant. You know, I still remember the sound of the gun blast and the way it felt with my face blowing apart.
So you felt everything because you were high on meth. So most people would have passed out, but you weren't able to do that because your body was hyped up, right, David?
Yeah, right.
Oh, my God.
I should have been unconscious.
Yeah, you should have been, but you had to feel it all. Well, when did you actually pass out to where you weren't cognizant of what happened?
I eventually passed out in the ambulance. They wanted to airlift me from my house to Nashville, Tennessee, to a trauma center, but they couldn't get the helicopter pilot to get me because he was picking somebody else up already. And so they decided to take me 2.5 hours from where I live to the trauma center because the first little hospital they took me to, they told, which was about 10 miles down the road from us, they told my wife, they said, we got to get him to the trauma center or we're afraid he's going to die. We're not equipped for this kind of injury. And when they told Amy that, She said, "What do you mean he's going to die?" She said, "He was just talking to us." And I was actually talking to him. They told her there was no way I could talk to anybody because the tip of my tongue was blown off and the rest of my tongue was split too. And my mouth was disintegrated. But I did. I talked to my wife, my mother, who they had called, and she had got down there at the house right after I pulled the trigger. And I told both of those women I was sorry. I told I talked to the police and the first paramedics. And so they decided to take me 2.5 hours from there in an ambulance. And they said I had already blacked out. I don't actually remember being at that hospital. They said when they would talk to me and was telling me, "We're going to take you to Nashville," they said I would raise my arm, indicating that I understood what they were saying. But I don't actually, I had actually already blacked out.
Finally, you had blacked out.
Yeah.
So you were talking. So God spoke through you even without, you know, the need of a tongue. You were able to communicate, which, you know, the Spirit shows that it lives on beyond what we understand. And, you know, I can't help but think, David, that your life was spared for you to do what you're doing now, because from what I understand, whenever you came to, you went from that point. I think, did you have a few operations, and then you went and started talking to children, or?
Yes. I started talking to young people 11 months later after I shot myself.
Okay.
I asked God, I woke 3 days later when I woke up in the hospital, I asked God to come into my heart and change me and to please forgive me for what I'd done. I realized what I had done to my family and to a lot of people. And on the sixth day, I wrote down on a notebook, I told my wife I wanted to tell people the truth about drugs. And I didn't realize when I wrote that, actually, I don't think I even realized what I was writing. I mean, I just knew I had the guilt in my heart of selling dope in my community for 20 years, and I realized I had sold a lot of death and destruction. So when I come home, it was months later when I got strong enough to move around, my wife started asking me, saying, "Are you going to go talk to people like you said?" And at this point, I had got to where I was talking again, because it took me a couple months before I could start speaking. I kind of learned how to speak all over again. And I just started speaking pretty good, where you could understand most things I said. And I told my wife, I said, "I want to wait till they get me fixed. I'm embarrassed about the way I looked, and the doctor told me one day he'd be able to fix me to where I look pretty normal." And my wife is the one that kept encouraging me week after week, saying, "Don't wait till they fix you." She said the Lord had put on her heart for me to go now. Let them see what it's done to me. Tell them what it's done to our family, and hopes if they're using, they'll stop before it kills them. And if they haven't started, maybe they won't start. I realized Amy was right. I'm not a bit embarrassed about the way I look anymore. I even feel guilty about feeling that way in the beginning, because I am permanently disfigured in the face. But the way I look at it, if the way I look will help a young kid not want to put this poison in their bodies, then my looks are a blessing from God. And I go all over the country. But I started talking 11 months later in a youth group at a church. Then I went from that to jails. And within about 6 months, I did my first junior high, the eighth grade class. And the following school year, the beginning of the school year for 2004,
that's
whenever it really just exploded. Whenever the newspapers and the local TV stations found out I was talking to kids about meth, they started coming and covering it. And the more they would cover it, the more schools would call. And it just spread like that. For me, it spread like wildfire. I mean, I just couldn't believe in a matter of just a couple years, I went from just talking around Tennessee to, now it's only been 3.5, 4 years, and we've been in 30 states and Canada about 10 times, and London, England, and halfway around the world. And it's just really, it's really amazing to me how fast it took off.
Well, I would think if you were able to reach even 3 children out of all the children you talk to, and let them know that we're here to be alive, to choose life, to live life to the fullest, that your whole purpose has been fulfilled. You know, I cannot imagine what would be more effective than actually for the kiddos to see your face and what can happen physically. Because, you know, when you're real young, I would think that what you see before you might be more impressionable than all the rational, intellectual discussions, but they can look at you and they say, oh, this is what could happen. And I just don't know what else would be that effective in combating what other people are telling the kids, that this can give you bliss, this is going to make you happy, and all those things, David. I mean, if they don't have anything to contrast that with, then how would they know? And that's why I think what you're doing is just an invaluable service to children.
Well, we've had a lot of, so far we've had a lot of really positive feedback from the kids themselves, and it's so encouraging when they write you things like, Mr. Parnell, please don't stop doing what you're doing. You really changed me and my friends' lives, and I'm going to tell you, I have never had anything that made me feel as good whenever I have a young person make that kind of comment to me. It really puts a fire in me and makes me want to go and go and go and go, you know. So
right, and keep doing. Well, you know, actually, I'll share something with you and our listeners. I'm sure you already probably read it, but since David was on our show, and I did have to delete that because of technical problems, but a couple of weeks ago, a publisher actually wrote me and said that if David was interested in having his story written, that there might, you know, well be somebody that would write it, a ghostwriter, and that he would definitely work with him on that. And I think that that alone explains perhaps the importance of David's life. A lot of people go through maybe what he's gone through, except not to the suicide, or if they do the suicide, they may not be here to talk to us like David is here. But if there is a book where children can read about it and see pictures, and maybe from the book would come a movie, you know, a TV movie, a movie, who knows? But I feel like the universe is using or has picked up David to share in order to prevent and to show people this is what could happen if you keep going on the path you're going, and it might be a better choice to say no. Now, I know it's not a popular show. I would think that people don't want to hear about it. But, you know, David, to me, it's like life is so brief. It's so like here, this second, gone tomorrow, that somebody like you telling the younger children that if you do this, this may happen. I mean, it's like I was so glad to hear that publisher offer to help you. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, that was very exciting. We've had contact with two or three different people over the years, and but that was very exciting to hear that. And I know that there is a big need for the drug education and for stories like that. And I know that because, see, when we do a school,
mm-hmm.
we usually do a nighttime program also for the community, because I really believe it's as important to educate the grandparents and the parents just as important as it is to educate the kids. And we've did programs where we would have 4,000 or 5,000 people show up, I thought, what in the heck is going on, man? Why, I couldn't believe the crowds that would show up. But what it is every one of us in this country are affected by drug addiction in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Either it's somebody we know, a family member, a friend, or, which I don't talk about during the program because people's lives are so much more important than money. But if we're not affected by somebody we know, it's our tax dollars. And in one way or another, we are affected by drug addiction in this country, every single person. And I realized that when I started seeing these kind of crowds show up at these nighttime forums. With me, it's all about reaching people. If the more people I can reach, that's the reason I feel like God left me here, was to try to reach people with a positive message. And if I can reach more than with doing a book, because I didn't want to do that in the beginning. I just wanted to go out and speak and have that personal thing. But I realized that, I can't reach all the people I want to reach. And I know with a book or something on that line that I could reach so many more kids. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, and this This person actually offered to get a ghostwriter, which means that all you'd have to do is give them the outline of the story and they would do it. And I think you're right. It's like, well, you can go around to all the schools, but, I mean, what happens when you're gone? So if a child has a book to read and pictures, you know, to see and whatever, I don't know how the book would be done, but, I mean, if children have that to look at, then it could save a life. You know, I'm really thinking that you're right. You were stopped from killing yourself, David. I feel for a reason. And even though you and I are not able to totally see the scope of that reason, there had to be. There was no, I mean, to me, there shouldn't have been a reason that you were able to kind of live through that. I mean, that alone, that bullet, wouldn't it have done most people? Wouldn't it have killed most people, David?
Well, the doctors, at least that's what they tell me.
Okay.
You know, I see the pictures. I show the crime scene photos, and when I look at the pictures, because the pictures that I show the kids and show audiences is pictures of me laying in my bedroom floor with my face blown apart. And when I first seen them, I couldn't believe the damage because, you know, of course, when I woke up, they had already sewed me up. And,
sure.
But that was a picture before they even brought me out of my bedroom, and I could see why the police had told me that they didn't think there was no way I would make it because the damage that was done was just tremendous. And the doctors called me at that first hospital. The nurses do. They still call me the miracle man around this area because they just couldn't believe that I made it to Nashville. They didn't think there was no way I would actually make the 2.5-hour trip, but I did, and thank God. And I don't have any brain damage. They said just from the drug addiction alone, I should have brain damage from all the
right.
years of using meth, plus the
sure.
swelling of the brain and trauma that day. But yet I have no brain damage, and they said at Nashville that they really couldn't explain that I was just a very, very lucky man. And so, yeah, I should have. I feel like I probably should have been dead on most normal incidents like that.
Right. So God had a higher plan for you. And it appears to me that it may be higher than what you think. You know, often people are used in ways that we don't understand. And when I first heard your story, I thought, oh, my gosh, this guy has got to be heard. And I knew you were being heard. You know, you were going around to schools, and I thought, if there was a higher way, you know, like a next level and a next level, because if a child is offered a drug to end their problems or make them feel better, whatever they tell, you know, a really young child, which I don't know, if they have nothing to play that off of, so they're going to go ahead and, okay, why not? But if they have something they remember in their mind, ooh, I remember this guy came to our school or, you know, I read the book about, and I saw the pictures. You know what I mean? I'm talking about the real young kiddos in
yeah.
elementary.
Oh, yeah.
They are affected, right, David?
Oh, yeah.
The elementary?
We see them down in elementary. There was a school here close to me that rated a junior high, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, and they took 32 of them out that they found drugs in the locker, and that's in junior high, 32 of them. Out of just a couple hundred, you know, 200 or 300.
Wow.
So yeah, each generation, it seems like the addiction just keeps working its way to where it's younger and younger. From when me and you probably was in school, the usage has gotten much younger than it was back then. And I think you're absolutely right. That's such a beautiful point that you made. If they have nothing positive to go back on, and all they hear is that, hey, this drug is going to make you feel good because
right.
The dealers are all they care about is the money. I try to tell young people, if you really think they're your friends, just don't pay them for those drugs, and you'll see how fast that they're your friends. And so they'll tell them anything to get them to buy the drug. And if these kids don't have nothing to fall back on and say, hey, I know that's a lie. I know what this stuff will do to you and what it does to most people and how it robs most people their hopes and their dreams. And if they don't have that to fall back on, well, of course, a lot of them's going to believe. The person
that's right. They're going to believe. That's why I think a book is so important because it gives kids a way, you know, if they go to the library or whatever brings the book out, and they go, oh my God, this could happen. But I thought, you know, so-and-so just told me that I would be in bliss or heaven or whatever. They didn't tell me this could happen, you know, the end result of a lifetime of drugs. I didn't see this. And so, you know, it's kind of like getting that balance out there. And, you know, David, I feel like I really appreciate you coming back again. I won't keep you much longer because I think what you have said so far is extremely important. I don't expect, a huge audience to want to hear about this because it is heartbreaking. But on the other hand, it's life-giving. And that's my whole thought, is to pass on life to life. And you have done that. You are doing that. And I don't know how to really say, you know, thank you enough, because I think a lot of people just wouldn't have had the courage. Your wife, Amy, who said, go ahead and start doing it right now. Don't wait till you have the nose fixed and all. She was right, you know. I mean, yeah. That was an important step. And you listened to her for whatever reason. And, you know, I hope that anybody out there that wants to contact you will go to your website. And if you would give them that website address, David?
Yes, that's it. FacingTheDragon.org, O-R-G. And that's FacingTheDragon.org.
And if you have anybody out there that, or if anybody in the audience wants David as a speaker, they can contact him through that. And how far do you travel, David? Are you all over the United States, or how does that work?
Yeah, we're all over the United States. We've been to Palm Springs, California, and up into Oregon and Washington State just about a month ago, and from over to Buffalo, New York, and Syracuse two or three times, and up in the far, about as far north in Canada as you can possibly go on both ends of that country, and 75 miles from the Mexico border in Texas, and we're going to New Mexico in September, I believe, and we've hit 30 states, and pretty much every corner of the United States we've hit so far. We did 230 programs last year, and 150 of those was junior highs and high schools.
250 of how many?
We did 230 programs all together.
Uh-huh.
Out of that 230, about 150 of those programs was junior highs and high schools. That covered about half of the programs we did, because we do other things. We do churches and rehab centers, jails and state prisons, police conferences, community conferences, and just wherever the Lord opens the door, then I go.
You just go in. And I would encourage everyone to look forward to a book, Facing the Dragon, by David Parnell, because I believe with my whole soul that this book is extremely important. And I would also hope that, you know, Hollywood or wherever, Vancouver, that Hollywood is moved or is moving, that they would also open up to contacting David for a movie about his life, because with one movie, one film, an hour and a half, hour, whatever, the lives that will be touched will never, never be known. But I believe that we're responsible for our children. And you know what? They're waiting for us. And I really appreciate you being on my show again, David. It was so gracious of you to come back on. And if there is anything that we can do for you at any time, just let me know, and I will connect you with that publisher.
Okay. Well, thanks, Judy, for letting me come back. It's really my pleasure to do it, and it's been such a blessing to even have met you, even though we haven't seen face-to-face. It's such a blessing to have talked to you, so thank you very much.
Thank you, David. And good night, everybody. From Judy Joy Jones Show in Blog Talk Radio Land. And I want to give a special shout out to Blog Talk Radio for inviting all of us to join hearts and hands and become one family as we move into other planets. Blog Talk Radio is ahead of its time. And thank you, David.